Good morning. I'll be reading from Mark 6, verses 45 to 56. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately, he spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. They ran throughout that whole region and carried the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched it were healed.
So as I was setting up this morning, I realized I'm going to miss parts of this place. I love these oak trees. I won't miss the mics, various things, but I've been thankful for this location. As a kid, I remember every few years, my family and I would gather around a television set in our living room, and we'd watch a TV special in which the magician illusionist David Copperfield would pull some incredible stunt. Does anybody else have memories doing that? I have these really strong memories of doing that. One of the most memorable ones was in 1986 when Copperfield walked through the Great Wall of China. You begin by seeing Copperfield on one platform on one side of the Great Wall of China, and he kind of stands. He's very dramatic. I'd forgotten about. He presses up against the wall, showing that it's solid, showing that there's no secret passages going through the wall. And then his assistants come up and they put these translucent curtains around him and on the platform, and you see the silhouette of Copperfield starting to move through the Great Wall of China. And then as he moves through, you see the crowd on the top actually starts to kind of follow him as he goes through. And they even, for drama, they even have a monitor hooked up to his heart. So the whole time Copperfield's going through, it's to kind of show that he's still there and show that he's still alive. There's this dramatic part where as he comes through, the heart just stops and kind of flatlines for a few seconds. So he gets on the other side, and Copperfield emerges very dramatically on the other side of the Great Wall of China. As my sermon prep this week, I made sure and watched it several times. It was pretty amazing, I'll be honest. It was even more amazing as a six-year-old with a greater sense of wonder and awe and living in an era where I would watch this illusion and then I would go to bed. So no Googling, you know, how Copperfield did it, no tweets about how he did it. I was left at the kid staring up at the ceiling and thinking, how did he do that? We're going through the book of Mark, and we come today to a story that kind of feels like maybe a little bit like a Copperfield TV special from the first century. And for, especially during the 20th century, a lot of the quest was, how did Jesus pull this off? And there's been all kinds of speculation on what happened here, that maybe when the disciples looked over, Jesus was walking on the shore. Maybe a sandbar was there. A number of years ago, there was a Discovery Channel special, and someone was talking about how now the Sea of Galilee freezes like one day, maybe every 1,000 years. But then it was 160 years. So what happened that day was that Jesus happened to catch it on the day, that one day in 160 years where the Sea of Galilee freezes, and he's able to actually walk out on the ice. That'd be amazing in its own right. Or so there's that. There's been a lot of people who have kind of taken that tack. Or it can sound kind of like a first century Jesus Christ Superstar special. In the musical Jesus Christ Superstar, Herod taunts Jesus to walk across my swimming pool. So walking on water is kind of like a parlor trick. It's like it's something he does to impress his disciples. Or maybe the temptation for us who have been in the church most of our lives, have heard this story, is that we don't doubt it. We're not really impressed with it. We're just kind of maybe bored with it. Like, yeah, we're scared and we just need to let Jesus in the boat. I appreciate what Ellen said, because she's eager to hear the passage again. I was like, oh, that's really nice as a preacher to hear that. So what the problem with each of those approaches is that there's a chance we'll miss what's at the heart of this. So let's look at this story. Your passage is on the back of your bulletin. We're in Mark 6:45. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to Bethsaida. So Jesus is sending his disciples to Bethsaida, a town that's to the east, kind of northeast of where the feeding of the 5,000 happened. And so kind of note that in your head, and we'll come back to that later. There's a sense of urgency in what Jesus is doing. He hustles the disciples into the boat. The language here is quite strong in the Greek. Jesus forcefully puts his disciples into a boat. Now, why would Jesus do that? Why is Jesus forcefully, hello? Why is Jesus forcefully pushing his disciples into the boat? Well, last week, remember, we had a feeding of 5,000 men. We kind of talked about how it's not just a relaxing picnic in the hills. It sounds, is Jesus like this introvert? Sometimes I go to gatherings with my wife and she is even more introverted than I am and she's exhausted and wants to get out of there. Is that what's happening here? Does Jesus need to like just get out of here and go recharge his batteries? But we saw last week that these 5,000 men have probably gathered in hopes and expectations of an insurrection, of being armed and led up into an uprising against Rome as a freedom fighter. It's probably that's happening more than a picnic. And it makes a little bit more sense why Jesus is like, let's get out of here. He knows his disciples are not immune to the messianic contagion of the crowd. So instead of sticking around for dessert and coffee, Jesus ends the meal, he hustles the disciples out of there, and he gets them on a boat to Bethsaida. He then goes up on the mountain to pray. So let's think about this, because there's only three times in Mark's gospel where Mark says that Jesus goes off to pray. The first one is at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, back in chapter 1. He's just cast out an impure spirit and healed Simon's mother-in-law. And word at this point is spreading throughout Galilee about all these amazing things that Jesus is doing. And there's then these huge crowds that are gathering around his house. And that's when the next day, Mark says, Jesus gets up very early and he goes out on his own and he prays. And when the disciples find him, they say, hey, everyone's looking for you. Like probably meaning like, hey, let's get back to the healing. And Jesus says, let's leave. Let's get out of here. I got to go preach. That's why I've come. So he does this kind of hasty departure. So jump ahead to today. We've got, again, a huge crowd gathered around Jesus. There's a miraculous feeding of 5,000. People are looking at Jesus and saying, let's do this. Let's take the fight to Rome. And so what does Jesus do? He takes to the hills to pray. He goes to a solitary place to be with the Father. And I said last week, like, don't think that Jesus wasn't tempted by what was transpiring in front of him. There's 5,000 men, maybe more, that are gathered to make him king. So Jesus rejects that option. He rejects that path. And he goes to talk with the Father to get clarity on the Father's will. And so to make sure that his mission is in alignment with the Father's mission. So right now you have a very human side of Jesus coming out, of talking to the Father in prayer, of going up this mountain to make sure that his mission is in alignment with the Father's. Anybody ever walked on water, like probably not. That we're going to see a side of Jesus that sounds nothing like us, okay? That we cannot relate to in any way. But anybody ever come up into a situation in life, a decision, a crisis, and the question that's going through your mind again and again and again is, what is God's will here? God, I want to be faithful. I want to go where you're leading me, but there are all these voices in my head telling me what to do, like 5,000 of them. Sometimes it seems voices telling me what to do, and I don't know what to do here. So think about it. If Jesus, when all the voices are coming at him, needs to go to be alone with the Father in prayer, to get clarity on the Father's will, to get courage to move in that direction, how much more do we need that? How much more do we need clarity and we need courage? It's interesting to me that the only words that Jesus says in this whole passage are, take courage, it is I, don't be afraid. Like, I was thinking about this week. I wonder if that's what Jesus hears from the Father while he's praying. Like, this path I'm calling on you, it does not lead to a triumphant military victory in Jerusalem. It leads to a cross, but take courage. It's I. Don't be afraid. I just want to, like, just like a first kind of practical thing. If we want to be attuned to the will of the Father, we need to see this example. We need to be spending time in prayer with God in communication. Verse 47. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. So Jesus looks out and he sees the disciples straining at the oar. The Greek word here is really interesting. It actually means to torment. And it can describe, at one place in Mark's gospel, it describes torment by demon possession, but it can also refer to things that take an extreme amount of physical effort and discomfort. It's used in one place in the New Testament to describe the contractions in childbirth. I've never experienced childbirth contractions, but I've rowed against the wind. And I know it can be super hard to row against the wind. It can feel torturous, which, Krishana, correct me if I'm wrong, does that mean I have some idea what child contraction? No, okay. By this point in the story, like, you're probably, are you recognizing some similarities between the last story that sounded like this, back in chapter 4? Both happen in the middle of the night. Both have disciples in a boat. They're struggling with the wind. But this time, I want you to note, the disciples are not in physical danger. They're straining. They're frustrated. They can't seem to make any progress. And Jesus sees them from afar. So shortly before dawn, Jesus goes out and begins walking on the lake. So depending on your translation, the NIV says before dawn. A more literal translation is between the fourth watch of the night. So between 3 and 6 a.m., Jesus walks out towards the lake. So it's easy to miss this because it's all happening fast, but Jesus sees them at night, and then it's apparently waits until almost dawn to actually go out toward them. So Jesus has been realized they've been struggling all night. He was about to pass them, but when he saw them walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because all saw him and were terrified. Let me read that again. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. It's a very odd sentence. I think it's by far the weirdest sentence in this whole passage. So Jesus has watched them struggle all night. He's finally decided to move towards them. And we can assume Jesus is moving to help them, right? And then Jesus gets close, and it's like he just keeps going. Like, what is happening here? Is Jesus stretching his legs after a long night of praying? Like, did he get close enough? He's like, nah, I'm just going to keep going. When I was studying this with the group from Midway, I mean, that was a question somebody asked, and I might have tried to answer it, but I think probably my head was like, I have no idea what's happening here. If you're thinking that, like, I get it. It's easy to throw up your hands and be like, I don't understand what's happening here, but don't do that, because this is actually one of the most important parts of this passage. And part of the reason we miss it is because my mind and your minds most likely are not saturated with the Old Testament like it would have been for the Jewish people. So hang with me a minute. We're going to do a little Old Testament detour. And I want to take you to two conversations that that Moses has with God. So the first one is Exodus 3:14. And if a little background here, God has appeared to Moses in the burning bush. He's told Moses that he's going to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. And Moses is like, are you kidding me? Like, suppose I go to the Israelites, like, who am I going to even say sent me? What's your name? And then God responds, I am, you probably know this, I am who I am. That's what you're going to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And then jump ahead to Exodus 33. There's another conversation. So now we're after the Israelites have been delivered from slavery. They're out in the wilderness. They've received the law, the Ten Commandments. But things have gone wrong too, because Moses emerges from the mountain and they've crafted a golden calf. And Moses is like, I'm done. I don't want to go any farther unless I know you're with me. And God says to Moses, get in the cleft of the rock and I will pass by and show my glory and show my goodness. So did you catch that? I will pass by. One last passage from Job 9:8. This is talking about God, he alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the seas. Who treads on the water? In the Old Testament, the only person who can walk on water is God. But then a couple of verses later in Job, it says, when he passes me, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. So do you see what's happening on the lake here? Like, this isn't some trick. This isn't some illusion. This is a picture of Jesus doing what only God can do in the Old Testament, treading on the waves. It's not a prophet. It's not a superhero. It's the very Son of God passing by, not because he's unconcerned, because he, and really through Mark's language, is using this incident to disclose who he is. You know, in some of the other gospels, Jesus says who he is. In Mark's gospel, he shows us who Jesus is. So this Jesus is the same God who liberated the Israelites from Egypt and who passed by Moses in the cleft of the rock to assure him of his presence, is now passing by the disciples in the boat. So this passing by is super significant words in the Old Testament. It's God's caring and presence, and it's really easy to miss. Like, for us, it's easy to miss. I'm sure the disciples missed it at the time, probably as they reflected, realized what was happening. Because they're not comforted. They're actually terrified. Remember, these are seasoned, at least a number of these are seasoned fishermen. They're used to being out on a boat in the middle of the night, straining at the oars. What they're not used to doing is seeing a person walk on water. Like, that for them is terrifying. And at this moment, Jesus speaks to them and says, take courage. It is I, don't be afraid. So that is a good translation of that. The Greek here is ego eimi, which means it is I, it's me. But it also can be translated I am. And I'm almost surely Mark didn't want us to miss that. The same words that God uses to reveal himself to Moses, now Jesus uses. And for Mark's readers, for us, Jesus is doing only what God can do. And if you remember from for our last story, on the bait, when the storm was calm, the question we were left asked by the disciples is, who is this? Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? So Mark here is answering that question. Who is this? This is the embodiment of the God of Israel. This is the I am. This is the one who treads on water. This is the one who passes by in the flesh. But there's an important difference here between Jesus passing by the disciples and revealing who he is and God passing by Moses in revealing his name. When Moses heard God speaking to him from the burning bush, Moses went over to the bush and God said, don't come any closer. Stop right there. Don't come any closer. And then later on, when Moses asked God to show him his glory, God says, okay, I'll do that. I'll cause my goodness to pass in front of you. I'll proclaim my name, but you can't see my face. Because if you see my face, you're going to die. So a few individuals in the Old Testament encounter God, but there's always limits on what you can see, how close you can get. And, you know, what happens in this story? The God of Israel, who said to Moses, don't come any closer, this mysterious and enigmatic God who treads on the waves, this majestic and awesome God who says, you can see my back, but you can't see my face or you'll die, is now standing face to face with the disciples. as now he's not passing by, he's turning. He's climbing in the boat with them. And the wind dies. And they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. So this is a little surprising. All this is happening in front of the disciples, and yet they don't get it. Their hearts are hardened. The last time Mark used these words, hearts hardened, are to describe Jesus' enemies, the people who are trying to kill him, the Pharisees who begin to plot after the miracle. And so the people who are closest to Jesus, who have seen the miracles, who just saw just yesterday him feed 5,000, they have hard hearts. They're not able to see and understand what's happening in front of them. And I said earlier, the disciples are not in physical danger. The danger in this story is not physical danger. They're straining at the oars. I'm sure they're super frustrated, but they're not in physical danger. The danger in this story is not physical, it's spiritual. The danger is that those closest to Jesus still don't get who he is. And this is pretty sobering, because it means proximity to Jesus does not equal a softened heart. Let me say that again. Proximity to Jesus does not equal a softened heart. It does not equal a heart and mind who are open to seeing who Jesus really is. So why is that sobering? Because it means that faith, as the Bible understands, is not something that happens automatically because you're in the vicinity of Jesus. You can be close to Jesus. You can come to church every week. You can sing the songs. You can listen to the sermon. You can still have a hard heart. You can still be far from Jesus. You can be like the disciples who have Jesus standing right in front of them. They don't get it. The danger in the story is not the wind. The scary part of this story is not the ghost. The threat in this story is not of a capsizing boat. It's hard hearts. Faith, in Mark's gospel, is a choice. And here's what I want you to hear. It's a choice that more often than not must be made in the face of struggle and trepidation. More often than not, it's a decision made in the face of struggle and trepidation. As one commentator put it, discipleship is more endangered by lack of faith and hardness of heart than by external dangers. Discipleship, following after Jesus, is more endangered by lack of faith and hardness of heart than external dangers, which, if we're honest, is not how we typically think about it. I think, let me give you two examples of why I think we actually think the exact opposite. Think about what constitutes the bulk of our prayer lives. What is it we pray about most? Very often, it's protection from external dangers. Safety, protect us as we travel. Health, protect our health. Protect our property, protect our kids, protect our loved ones. The bulk of our prayer, if we're honest, for a lot of us, tends to be asking for protection from external threats. And that's totally understandable. It's good to pray for these things. But how often do we pray against the protection of a hardened heart? From hearts that are unable to refuse to see what God is up to in front of us. Prayers that not only miss Jesus, where he's showing us, or prayers that we not only miss Jesus is, but we're missing what Jesus is showing us. Let me give you one more example of how I think I miss it. Today, like I think maybe the parents would agree with this. Being a parent, it seems like if you take all the recommendations for safety for your child, it'd be like a full-time job. If you don't believe me, like go to a playground and where all like the fun stuff has been taken away and listen to how many times you hear, be careful. Don't do that. Don't get too close. Like probably some of those are going to be coming from me. Like I was writing the sermon this week and Isaac went closer to the street and I was like, be careful. I was like, ugh. Like we're trained as parents to be like constantly aware of every danger that's lurking around the corner. But here's the irony. When we focus on that, so often we miss the real dangers. Like if you listen to child psychologists, they'll tell you as a child does something risky, they're learning that balance between how far can I go and when do I need to stop? And sometimes they fall, and that's good because they learn that on their own. So sometimes as parents, we protect our kids so much that we're actually missing the real danger. Or here's another example. Numerous times in Columbiana, I've been talking to someone and kind of lamenting that like there's not as many kids out like running around and playing and stuff. And they're like, yeah, I was, you know, when I was growing up in Columbiana, it was different, but you know, today things are different. And I want to say, you're right. Like statistically, you're probably safer today than you were when I was growing up in the 80s. Like if you look at the statistics, like you're likely like safer. And so like you miss the real danger. The real danger isn't that our kid's going to get kidnapped in Firestone Park. This is Columbiana. The real danger is that our kids are going to be deprived of what happens when you go out in the neighborhood of interactions with other kids and them having to work out conflict and all the, most of us who grew up, all the great things that happen when you leave and you go out of the neighborhood. I just give that, we miss the danger. We focus on one thing when actually what's really dangerous is something totally different. And this passage is a reminder that it is possible to be very close to Jesus and miss who's in front of you. You miss the danger. You have this kind of designer Jesus in front of you. It's a very small Jesus. It's a Jesus who thinks like you and talks like you and votes like you. And you miss the I am who's passing in front of you, who's treading the waters. That's not a small Jesus. That's dangerous. It's a threat to our faith. Let's keep going. Jesus gets in the boat with his disciples and they head to the land of Gennesaret. So this is kind of odd because remember, I told you to try to remember this. When Jesus puts his disciples in a boat, he sends them to Bethsaida, which is to the east of where they were. But Gennesaret, which is actually kind of more of a region along the coast, is in the opposite direction of Bethsaida. So it's to the southwest of Bethsaida. So they get in a boat. It's kind of hard to get in your minds, but think of the Sea of Galilee. We're up in the northwest part. They head east to Bethsaida, but then they land in the southwest at Gennesaret. And it's not entirely clear what's happening here, but perhaps this strong northeast wind that's coming in, which they're having to strain against, which is battering them, has actually blown them off course. Anybody ever feel like their life has been blown off course? Anybody ever feel like, man, I heard some really clear directions from God. I heard God say, go to Bethsaida. You follow that. And soon you find yourself battered by waves. You find yourself straining at the oars. You find yourself completely blown off course. I'm sure at some point the disciples are like, wait, why did Jesus send us this way? Like, why did Jesus send us into the wind? Especially when they arrived at Gennesaret and they're like, wait, what happened here? But think about this. Look back at your life. When have you encountered God? When have you caught a glimpse out of the corner of your eye of God passing by? Often, I think, it's when we're straining at the oars. It's when you feel like you're battered in the wind. It feels like you're making zero progress. It feels like you're actually losing ground. Your life has been blown off course, and out of the corner of your eye, you see God passing by. And you realize you're not alone. If Jesus wants to reveal himself to his disciples, like, why doesn't he do it on the mountain where he's praying? Why is he watching all this unfold? Like, I love mountains. I've climbed a fair amount of mountains in my life, and I've sat up on summits where I've gone up to seek God, and I have been amazed at the views in front of me. I like the idea of encountering God on a mountain. I like the idea of God passing me by on a mountain. Or maybe you like the idea of encountering God on the beach in Florida, watching the waves break in. Or at a retreat center doing yoga and sipping a latte. Or on a hike in the woods or gardening in your backyard. It's where we want to encounter God. We typically want to encounter God in safe places, don't we? And yet, where do we actually have most of our intense encounters with God? We want to encounter God on a mountain when things are well and on vacation when life is good. But when we look back at our lives, often the moments when we actually felt God near were in the middle of the lake, in the middle of the night, straining at the oars, exhausted, ready to give up, in scary, tough places, in the hospital, in the middle of a job loss, at a funeral, in the midst of a painful breakup, in a place that we would have never chosen to be sent. It's there we look up and we catch a glimpse of God and realize that we're not alone, that the I am is there. And it's at these moments when we least understand what is happening in our lives, we feel like they've been completely blown off course, that we need to hear the words that the disciples heard. Take courage, don't be afraid. It's me, it's I. You thought you were alone, but I am here. I am faithful. I am your companion. I'm your guide on this journey. Even when you couldn't see me, I am. Even as you were straining at the oars in the darkness, when you felt like I'd abandoned you, I was there. I was watching for you. I was praying for you on the mountain. I was praying for strength, and I was praying for courage. As disciples of Jesus, we are never promised protection from external storms, as much as we'd like to think that was the case. But remember, it's not the external storm that's the most dangerous thing in this passage. It's the internal one. It's right here. It's a hard heart. That's the scariest thing in the passage. And Jesus doesn't rescue his disciples from the sea, but he enables them to continue their voyage. And the promise from Jesus to us as disciples, not that we're going to avoid storms, but that we're not alone in the storms. You know, we saw last week that Jesus has compassion on the crowds. And now Jesus has compassion on his disciples. He has compassion on us, his disciples. The God of Israel, the I am, the one who treads on water, who passes by, has turned towards us that we might see his face. And his face looks like Jesus' face. Our family's been going through the TV series on the internet called The Chosen. And I've enjoyed it. One of the things I like is seeing an image of Jesus, because we're reading, looking at someone. So one of the last episodes we watched, Matthew, the tax collector, is not yet a follower of Jesus, but he's kind of hanging around the edges. And he's going through a lot of turmoil in his head. And there's this great scene where Jesus looks up and sees Matthew, and Matthew sees Jesus. I love that. I love that Jesus turning and looking and saying, I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you, Matthew. The disciples don't get it. They fail. Their hearts are hardened. And a couple chapters later, they're going to be again in a boat. Jesus will have just fed 4,000 people, and they still won't get it, and they will fail again. But Jesus doesn't give up on them and their failures. He doesn't say, like, let's start over with 12 new ones. These guys are beyond help. No, he gets in the boat. He takes them over to the other side, takes them to Gennesaret, and they start the whole process over again so that one day they might get it. And they do. It takes a while, but they do. If you don't get it, you're in good company. If you admit that you don't get it, that's a much better place than having a hardened heart. If you are still struggling to get it, don't give up. The I am sits on a mountain praying for you, moving towards you, and turning his face towards you.